Hi, Dan.
Hello, Jason.
Are you still cold from being out in the snow?
It's very cold. It's very cold here. I'm very windy.
You're drinking some tea. That's good.
I'm drinking some hot tea.
I'm going to do that too.
Hot tea. Yeah. Mm. That is good Foley.
It's 60 degrees here.
Oh my God, but, that sounds amazing.
But it is raining, so we got that going for us.
Oh, well, yeah, I'd still take it. I can't help but think back to being
It's 14 degrees in Boston right now.
Oh, yeah. Well,
for our Celsius-using people, that's minus 10. It sounds even more impressive when it's minus 10. Ah!
That probably doesn't even include the wind chill either, which is where they get you. That's like feels like zero or less.
I don't pay attention to wind chill and feels like, and you know why? It's because whenever I put in my place of a residence, the numbers are always the same. Because out here, we don't have that generally.
You don't have humidity, you don't have wind chill.
Yeah, it's 60. It feels like 60 because it's 60. That's just it. But you guys get the wind chill and all that. And I know the people who listen to this podcast will love this part. Shoveling snow.
I shoveled some snow today, and I was musing as I did it about how, you know, there's that old saw about all the Eskimo words for snow, you know, which I think they've said is, I've heard variously true, not true, I don't know. Anyways, but it does occur to me that there really are, like, over the years of living in a very cold environment, you get to learn all the different types of snow that you encounter, because you've got like your wet, heavy snow, you've got your light, fluffy snow, you got your very crystallized snow, you got your ice slush. Like, it really is, there's a gamut. And there's different strategies for dealing with different types, because, you know, obviously you don't want to, like, you know, a shovel full of snow does not equal a shovel full of snow, depending on, say, how heavy that snow might be. So you can very easily throw your back out if you go in and be like, oh, yeah, I'll just get this big, huge shovel of snow. And it's like, wow, that's actually filled with sopping water and is very heavy, and you've now hurt yourself.
It's fascinating. Bomb cyclone. It's the bomb cyclone. That's what I hear.
We just call it a blizzard or a nor'easter like everybody else.
All right. Well, you're in the Northeast. If you want to call it a nor'easter, I guess you're allowed.
Every storm here is a nor'easter.
Yeah. I don't like how this has turned the weather podcast, but I don't like how the Weather Channel has decided to start naming storms.
Yeah.
All the other storms felt bad that hurricanes got names, but they didn't get names. So now they've all got names.
Is this one Grayson, someone said, I think, or is that the one that's to the south?
Yeah. It's Grayson.
I just like it because it's Robin.
It's Robin. Like,
Dick Grayson. Frickin' Nightwing and his snow.
Well, somebody said the reason this storm is so brutal is because its parents were killed in a horrible trapeze accident. So,
I was going to make a joke about coming back from the dead, but that's Jason Todd. So, you know, sorry.
I was workshopping a Jason Todd joke there. The next storm is Winter Storm Todd, but it's going to die out before it reaches Boston. See, there's my joke. There's my Robin joke.
Everybody in the country will call in to vote whether or not the storm dies out, is how it works.
I am surprised. Oh, that's a good reference. I am surprised Tony Sindelar hasn't just, like, broken into this podcast to demand we stop talking about Batman.
Well, we have to pay him his licensing fee.
What do we know about that? I'm coming to you from the iMac Pro. That's a thing that happened.
Oh, yes.
But I guess maybe we touched base on that last time. But that is a thing that has happened now, which is nice. I'm working on a review, but I'm not so much with the writing as with the using the iMac Pro so that I can experience it. I've been using it to do my work for the last week. And there are moments where it just feels like, you know, it's a computer. And then there are the moments where you need power, and it's got it. It's kind of amazing. So that was fun. That was a fun thing this week.
I mean, even just using a 5K iMac from this year has...
Oh, yeah. That's a big step up.
I'm always amazed. I was always amazed at how good it is. And I did see some people complaining, including our friend Stephen Hackett, about how loud it gets under load. Either I don't put it under enough load, or I just don't notice it, which is definitely... I'm not one of those people who's super sensitive. Like, yeah, if the fan kicks up to the point where every once in a while, like, a computer, you know, process goes amok, especially like websites these days with like all these like scripting things on them, and something will peg the processor. And yeah, if it cranks and I get like, I've heard the Mac Mini in the other room, like, who knows, something went awry and it's something is like taking the processor to max, and you can hear it. Absolutely. Yeah. But like in the normal everyday work that I'm doing with my iMac, which includes doing audio editing and logic and exporting stuff, I very rarely notice fan noise from it at all. But yep. I'm not very attuned to that, I guess. So
Stephen Hackett, had a real problem with it to the point where he sent it back. I mean, like, it's, and it does seem like the difference is, I mean, first off, the iMac Pro needs a huge amount of thermal capacity, and I have the base model, so, you know, there's going to be a lot more heat thrown out by the 14 core. But my understanding also is the most thermally challenging part is the GPU, and that's not something I generally do tax, although it turns out when you do encoding video, that's that the GPU is doing that. Which I didn't realize. Well, so here's a funny story. I didn't put this in my... I wrote a piece on Macworld this week about the T2, because I got some information about that and was able to kind of work a story there separate from my review.
Technically, it's the Terminator 1000. Let's just be clear.
Yeah, well, it's you know what happens?
Please specify the name, Jason, and the number.
This iMac is for Judgment Day. How about that? Are you happy with that? I know now
points.
Why you IMAX cry, but it's something I can never do because I do not have a ventilation fan that is proper enough to cool my circuits.
I can't reach the bell, but if I could.
Thank you. So that T2 stuff aside, which I think is fascinating, actually, and people I mean, we could talk about it. It's fascinating, all of the talk about like a hybrid Mac, and what they're really doing is they're taking all of those other controllers that were in the iMac and... Or in every Mac, and they're like, you know, we can build an ARM chip that does all that. So they did, and so like the whole system controller, like the brain behind the brain or the brain over the brain, I'm not quite sure, is this T2 where it's doing the disk control. It's like the SSDs aren't even SSDs really; they're just banks of RAM that. Are controlled by the T2. There's no disk controller. It's the T2 that's doing it. And all the image signal processing for that, for the 1080 FaceTime camera, which looks great, by the way, and that's one of the reasons why. That's all happening inside the T2. Well, all the security stuff, all the encryption stuff, all the stuff that would be on like separate processors. And Apple's like, nah, we can build that. And so they did.
That's classic Apple, too, right? I mean, taking a bunch of features and then rather than relying on third-party components and trying to cobble it all together, basically saying like, well, what if we just did a thing? What if we made a thing? And that's, you know, you keep seeing all the reports about Apple getting into different types of chips and different types of taking away sort of features that had been previously third-party things, so like power management or wireless or modems, right? Like all these things that they're kind of investigating. And it's not really a surprise that they'd want to build them themselves because the deep level of control that they can get out of that, the optimizations, the space savings, like all of that is a huge boon for them.
Yeah, and plus it's work they've already done. That's the thing, is most of this stuff is work they've done to a certain extent for the iPhone and the iPad.
Right, exactly.
And so it's like, yeah, we've got security and full disk encryption and, you know, and image signal processing. It's like, it's work that they already did, so why not put that in there? So that's all really interesting. And then the cooling thing, the GPU, why the GPU gets the video encoding. The answer there is that there are these media blocks on modern i5 and i7 processors, the ones that are in most Macs. And the media block is basically a dedicated part of the processor that does media encoding. And on your iMac, it's H.264 and H.265 or HEVC. On my 5K iMac, it was the older version, so it only had the media block for H.264. But the idea there is that there's like a dedicated part of the chip that will that is there on hardware optimized to do media encoding. So you don't have to use sort of like general purpose software encoder. It's got like accelerated hardware video encoding. Great. The Xeon processors don't have that media block. Because they're not consumer level processors, they're workstation level processors. They don't have that media block. So there were some stories in the last couple of weeks that are like, oh no, but it's going to actually be slower for a bunch of things. And some of those are true because, like, even though the Turbo Boost, which is all right, I'm parentheses inside parentheses here, but for people who don't know, the idea here is that okay, you've got 8 cores or 14 cores or whatever, but what if all you're doing is working on one core? And the answer is, and Intel processors have done this for ages now, is this Turbo Boost thing, where basically if we're only really using one core, we can crank up the clock speed and be faster on that one core. So if you compare one core performance between this and like a 5K iMac, they're not that far off in some ways, because one core is, you know, these processors, the Xeons, are not optimized for one core. They're optimized for 8 cores or 14 cores or whatever. That's why they exist. All right, so when it comes to video encoding, though, people are like, oh, it's going to be bad because they don't have the media block. Well, guess what? All your video encodes are going through the GPU, which is incredibly powerful and has the ability to do video encodes accelerated, is my understanding, for H.264 and H.265. So, and my experience doing a handbrake encode, by the way, it was like 65 frames a second or something like that. It was kind of nuts. Although the handbrake is, you know, it's filling the threads. It's using all the cores. So I guess my understanding of this anyway is that if you take you got to take your eye off the ball a little bit, which is counterintuitive, and say, okay, there's no media block in the processor, but there's this GPU sitting there and it actually is doing that work. Now, in terms of the fans too, like on your iMac, that fan cranks up when it gets hot inside. My as far as I can tell, the fan on the iMac Pro is always blowing,
right?
But it's super quiet, and the only way that I notice a difference is that it when I'm encoding video or something, is the air that comes out the back is warmer. That's it. And apparently, well, I mean, I don't know if the GPU is really, really going crazy. I don't know if it does crank up at that point, but I've never experienced an audible increase in fan noise from this thing. It is this. I'm sure if you're super sensitive and you're in a completely silent room, you can, and you put your ear by it, you can hear it, but it is not in practice. It might as well be silent for me.
A huge fan is, I mean, the assembly they showed when iFixit took it down, right?
Enormous, like, fans that are like way up, and then they have they're channeled out
over the CPU and the GPU.
Huge heat sinks, these two huge blowers, but the idea there is that they move a lot of air and they're pulling it through here and blowing it out there, and it's
it's mostly fan in there, right? Like behind the display,
and speakers. Honestly, right. Is a lot of it, and most of that is the room that they took out, because there's no, in your iMac and in all the 5K iMacs, there's room for a hard drive, right? Because you can do Fusion Drive, you can do just a spinning hard drive, or you can opt for the SSD. But if you opt for the SSD, they still have the space in there for a hard drive.
It's an enclosure, right? It's like in a 3.5-inch.
Yeah.
It looks like a hard drive. It's like a really light box,
big spinning hard drive, or equivalent. The iMac Pro has no room for a hard drive. They use that space. It's SSD only, and because of that, they have space to put in the cooling stuff, which is what they did.
So the question I had, and this was a thing that had been mentioned previously, was that the part of the functionality of that T2 might also include support for Hey Siri. Does it?
Yes.
Okay, so you can now trigger it without it being, like, without using the keyboard, essentially.
Yes, you can do that. I don't think I recommend it, because I don't think Siri on the Mac is particularly great.
No, I was just mainly curious. I've always been curious, because it struck me as the stuff that they did on the iPhone was designed in such ways to really reduce power consumption, right? Like, it's very streamlined so that it can respond while the device is sleeping, and the only thing that's actually listening is like this. It's basically on the motion coprocessor, right? Like, low power thing that's running at the same time, which always struck me as weird, because your Mac is plugged in all the time, so you shouldn't have to worry about the same constraints. And in fact, you know, when Hey Siri was first a thing, your phone had to be plugged in order for it to work. So it always struck me as bizarre that Apple never brought that feature to the Mac. But maybe, I don't know if it's just because they're concerned in, like, if your Mac goes to sleep, they don't want to spin up the full processor there either. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Hey Siri. No, let me see. I don't know. Maybe I don't have it. Oh yeah, it's here. Hey Siri. It's not listening right now. I do have an enable Ask Siri checkbox. I've set off everybody's phones.
It's all trained to voices
it's,
now.
Oh yeah, it totally can't be triggered by other people's voices. Anyway,
it rarely happens for me. It's not like the lady in the canister who doesn't care who you are.
Anyway, that is there, and that is apparently the reason. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it may be something just in the Mac architecture. It also, you know, it boots up twice, basically, because first the T2 launches and it does all its security checks and all that, and then it passes things on to sort of a more normal boot process after that. It's just, it's different, but in the end, it's just, you know, it's a Mac. It's a fast Mac, and it's and I'm liking it.
I will be interesting to see how that, I assume the T2 or, you know, descendant thereof will be making its way into other computers on the Mac line.
I feel pretty positive about the fact that this is coming. This is what the future of the Mac is. Yeah.
Right. The space saving on the laptop line alone would be a huge reason to do that. And presumably power management can be more optimized too. So on your MacBook or your MacBook Pro, it seems like having that in there would free up some space, would simplify things, would provide better optimization, better power efficiency, all of that stuff. So if they decide that they're going to rev a laptop this year, I would be surprised if it didn't include that.
It might take some time to get it, you know, completely in, right? I mean, it's possible that it'll be a year or two, but I just, this feels like... This doesn't feel like some gaudy thing that's been stuck on a high-end Mac and will never come anywhere. It's the high-end Mac because it's going to start there, perhaps, and roll down. But even, I mean, all the way through the product line, it just makes sense, right? That this is like Apple says, this is how we make Macs now. We make them more secure, and we have this. We have the processor that we built, and we're going to, you know, this is how the Mac experience is going to go. We're no longer going to have to integrate other people's system controllers. And as they move to SSD, they're going to say, well, we're going to control the SSD. We don't even want to use your SSD. We can do higher performance, and we can have full on-disk encryption of everything, passing through with no degradation because it's all passing through the processor. I can't see them not, other than the economics of it, but presumably over time, this will be worth it to them, removing components, simplifying to do it this way. Yeah, even keeping the Intel processor around for the kind of like, all, you know, the all the rest.
Heavy lifting.
Yeah, but everything else is on one of these Apple designed T chips.
Nobody worries about security in processors, Jason. That's not a thing that you should have.
Well,
and
if anybody's going to talk about T, it's you and me. So
indeed, that's true.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the security in processor thing with the Meltdown and Spectre, which have been making all the news this week.
Spectre. When is Smersh?
Least I was going to say the perhaps most underwhelming James Bond movie of the last few years. This is a bizarre story. And fascinating too, because the underlying architecture that causes this problem is essentially my reading of it, and I'm sure someone with more electrical engineering knowledge would be able to sort of supplement that, but like essentially our computers, making a computer faster and faster got to the point where it's like, well, our computers in some ways are, our processors are sometimes even faster than like we need them to be. So what they have, like they can do, is just start thinking about all the stuff that you might do and start executing based on that. Like, oh, I noticed the, you know, you're about to do this thing. Well, it usually involves this and this and this and this. And they just start doing it because they have essentially the extra power to just start, like, it's almost like caching data ahead of time. Like, and then if it decides not to go that direction, they just throw all that information out. But then that apparently it has effects that can be detected and might let you access that information.
Yeah, I mean, you really got to understand how processors work in order to break that down and look at it. But it is fascinating that this is something that, as a user of these things, you never even notice, but that this is going on in the background, where basically, in order to be faster, it's cheating. I was thinking about this because in talking to Apple about the iPad Pro and the getting the latency of the Apple Pencil down on the new iPad Pro, where it's like a higher, you know, it's got the digitizer is I think 120 meg or 120 hertz, and you can crank up the frame rate to 120 hertz, I think. And it's all in the service of having it be like, when you move your pencil, the Apple Pencil, across the screen, it feels like the pencil mark is right at the tip of the pencil and not trailing, you know, several millimeters behind it. And one of the ways they do that is they look at the speed and trajectory of the pencil, and they draw ahead because they think they know where you're going.
Right.
And if you don't go that way, then they, you know, it redraws and it changes it. But it's the same thing.
Why am I not a
better
artist then? Come on.
Well, it's just another one of these ways, like with the battery stuff, where part of it is this is incredibly technical and so people don't want to know. And part of it is that it benefits the technology company to make the users feel more comfortable, and some of it is in reality of like it feels better to have that thing tracking your pencil mark, but in fact what's happening essentially is that your computer is lying to you, but for good reasons. It's like human society. If you ever saw that movie The Invention of Lying, it's like human society. Like lies aren't always bad. In some ways lies are the thing that allows social currency to happen. But it's a little like that.
it gets philosophical too, right? I mean, the same idea that you could argue, you know, you can't, you know, people talk about not being able to trust what you see, right? And it's like, well, what you're seeing is a construction from your brain lying to you about what's out there in the world, right? It is not it's just the way vision works is not exact. It's not like it's your brain interpolating a bunch of different signals and stuff, right? Like, so, you know, what is truth, I guess, is what I'm saying, Jason.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Let's
unravel all of this. Let's burning it down.
Let's dig into it. That sounds like something that I would write in a paper in college. By which
how do you know that?
Because I saw some of my papers that I wrote in college, because I transferred all of my old Apple II discs this week. A project more than a decade in the making, in that I bought this Apple IIc in order to do this, like 2000, 2001.
I think we briefly touched upon this in our last show, but yeah, so you actually got it all working.
It's all working. I mean, I've done the whole process. In fact, at this point, Michael Gartenberg on Twitter was like, oh, I've got some old discs. Tell me how you did it so I can do it. And I said, you might want to just send me the discs, because you got to buy, you find yourself an Apple II, buy this custom built cable and a USB to serial converter so it will run on your Mac. And then you need to either buy a disc or kind of bootstrap. I did buy a disc, but I also did some bootstrapping, which was kind of cool, which it's like literally you type a couple of things in on the Apple II and then you run a program on your Mac and your Mac just starts typing things in to the Apple II. You just start seeing like machine code flying over to the Apple II, and then it basically like runs its own program, and then you save that to a disc, and then it can boot the disc, and then you can push more programs to it. And once you get it up and running, you can also do things like if you've got an image on your Mac, a disk image, you can stick a blank disk in the Apple II and basically say, copy this over. And so this is one of the ways that people get stuff up and running on an Apple II today, is they get it on disk image and then they connect via serial and they kind of write it over, and it turns from a disk image into an actual 5.25 floppy disk, which, you know, I have not typed init hello on an Apple II in 30 years, but I did it this week, which was super weird, and it takes me back. It's a fun thing to have done it. It is interesting. I mean, I'm going to write this up, but like, there are so many angles to this story. The user interface, like the word processor I used for high school and the first couple years of college, is Apple Writer, which is I also found some spreadsheets, by the way, that are using Apple Works for the Apple II, which is
bananas.
But Apple Writer, like, okay, it's basically just a blinking text area, and you can use your arrow keys to move around, and there's a ruler that hit the escape key, and it like shows you status, or it shows you tabs, or it shows you nothing. That's not bad, but like the little interface niceties that don't exist in it are fascinating. Like, if you want to load a new file and you just load it, it just gets inserted in the middle of what you were working on. If you truly want to just do what we would do today, which is open a new document, you need first say new, clear the old thing out, then open the new thing. Otherwise, it will actually insert the old inside the or the new inside the old, which is super weird. If you want to look at what's on a disk in Apple Writer, you have to hit Control O and then type, I think it's like A, and it will list the current directory or directory out. But you can't select any files from there. You have to remember what file you want and then exit that interface and go to Command L to load it and then type it in. And since it's ProDOS, if you've got like multiple disks in, you have to actually put in the path of the volume. So it's like suddenly I'm loading /F4/file name return, and then my file is there. Yay! It's just funny little things like that. And I was thinking about how primitive it was, and then I was also realizing that I learned how to use VI on Unix in 1988 when I still had this Apple II, and I still use VI today because it's still on every Mac, and you go in the terminal and you can edit text with it. And I don't choose to like write in VI because that would be madness, but I do use it sometimes to edit things on my Mac that I need to edit like configuration files and stuff. But I wanted to say, well, VI, it's way more advanced than, or Vim, whatever version is there now. It's way more advanced than Apple Writer. But is it? I still have to load those files with the command line. It's still got a very weird character-based navigation system. But in terms of like Mac interface niceties, the Apple II stuff is breathtaking because, like, of course, I want to open a new document when I open this document. Why in the world would you just insert it in the one I'm already working on? But that's just how dumb that program is it works that way. Also my other point here is, with 30 years of hindsight, everything gets a little, you'll find this out, Dan. I'll say for you, it's probably even true with 20 or 25 years of hindsight. There's all these things that you're like, oh, the good times. And in high school, I wrote papers. And in my case, like there's a computer bulletin board and I have those disks and I wonder what's on those disks. Like, what were we saying? And then you look at it and you're like, oh, it's just dumb teenagers saying stupid stuff. It's like, it's not, there's no.
Oh, no, there was so much profundity there, Jason.
Man, there is none. Like, I looked at one of my college essays I looked at one of my high school essays and I looked at one of my college term papers. And my thought was, kids, I know that when you're 18 or 20, people are going to tell you that you've got to, you want to be a writer, a professional writer. And then you look at your papers and you're like, boy, this stuff isn't good enough. Don't worry. You can write really dumb college essays and, still become a professional writer. Take it from me. 'Cause I've seen my writing in high school and college and, it's not so great. I look at it now. And so anyway, that's the danger of you can't go home again, Dan. So you probably shouldn't load the discs from home. That's what I'm saying.
But I guess you can shop there.
You can get married there actually in the house. Well, the house I grew up in, burned down, but the property that it's on and all the other structures and everything like that, for those who don't know, one of Northern California's premier wedding destinations. So if you're looking to get married in the historic Gold Rush country, you could get married.
And who isn't?
And they're booked every week for the whole year.
For
weddings. People want to be out in the country with, like, I don't know, horses and cows and stuff. And there's old barns, and you can get married in an old barn that we used to keep hay in to feed our cows. It's a true story. True story. And also I had these floppy disks that I read this week. Super, super. It's really cool. Like, I get the appeal of retro tech with this a little bit. Like, it is kind of, it gives you this weird perspective on where we are now. And in two ways, both in terms of how far we've come, but also I think in terms of how the limitations that we have now that we just don't even see because they just are, you got to be pragmatic, they are what they are, that given even a little bit of distance will be glaring. Like, that's the other,
oh,
other
sure.
Part.
I mean, I'm of just the right age that I can look back almost 20 years to stuff that I wrote that's on the internet. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah, like I found a post there. I know there's an old site that some friends and I used to run, and I found there's a post there that I wrote about Apple, and this is probably circa 2001, and I think it's around. It was writing up the event of the introduction of the Titanium PowerBook. And it was just sort of like, it was a lot of gushing of just like how awesome these things are. And I thought about that. I think I have memories of thinking about that when I first was getting ready to apply to be a writer at MacUser. And I think I even then looked back on it, and that was only like 5 years later. And I was like, oh, yeah, don't use that. That is not a good clip. So, I mean, I go back and I look at some stuff that I wrote, you know, more than a decade ago when I was starting my professional writing career. And some of it I feel like has aged okay, but there's a lot of it that is like, yeah, I learned so much between now and then. And, you know, going back even further, I have hard drives sitting around with like college and high school papers and stuff on them. And these are mostly, you know, at least they're on Macs. And they're even on some of them because I got Mac OS 10 just as I was leaving college. So some of them are even in like formats I could probably read. Although I don't know if there's anything left that opens Apple Works.
Apple Works in a Mac emulator actually is your best bet. And I do have a Mac emulator too. Well, what's funny about these floppy disks is I had a 3.5-inch disk drive for my Apple II. So mostly when I was in college, especially like my last year there, that's not on these floppies because I switched. I'd still like they held way more. Like these floppies hold like 130K or something like that, and those were like four. Well, I think 400 was what the Apple II could see, but those you could stick in a Mac and use the Apple II file converter to move them over from Apple II format to Mac. So the files I wanted to migrate to the Mac from that era, I do have in various places, I think, if I looked there. I don't look there, but I did save. So what I'm saying is the stuff that I wanted to save from that era, I did save. And a lot of the stuff that's on these discs is not stuff I wanted to save, which is funny because it's like me in 2018 overriding me in 1990 when or 1989 when I said, nope, I don't need those humanities papers. I don't need those, you know, I don't need my essay for the University of California application, which I found. It's not good. What was I thinking? How did they let me into college? Oh, my God. I guess the answer is there. It was competing with
it's a different time.
I was competing with a lot of other 17-year-old essays written by 17-year-olds. Right. So how good could any of them have
been? Yours probably had punctuation and everything.
Oh, sure. It's just not. Yeah. Anyway. So it's It's fun from that kind of archaeology standpoint. And I've looked at the other discs too, and they're all over the place. There's like the Star Trek text game. There's a couple of discs for that. The thing about the programs is most of the programs exist on, there are archives with like every Apple II program ever made. Like you can just download them. It's not a problem. So those aren't as notable to me as the ones that have just like my data on them, because like I don't need to image the Apple Writer 2 ProDOS boot disk. I can just download it.
Right.
But you know, my stupid files are only for me. So that was the it's anyway, my point is I can see how this is fun. I can see why Stephen Hackett does what he does. I haven't stored a lot of hardware over the years, mostly because I have not lived in a place where I felt comfortable using storage for stuff like old computers. Like we generally, they all get kind of recycled fairly quickly.
Right.
And mostly I don't regret that. But the Apple II, I kind of regret. So anyway, it's been a fun little trip down memory lane. And it is also a real reminder of how our expectations about like how we use computers have changed over the years. Cause it's kind of a blast from the past. So that's been a kind of a fun and weird thing. And at some point I will dive further into the actual texts that I've recovered, but at the very least, all of those discs that are in those little boxes that I've kept around, those 5 1/4 discs, have been imaged. So I've got them all on my Mac now. They're no longer sitting there. Oh, I should also say, like, the fact that floppy disks from 30 years ago are still readable.
Yeah, and, that's nuts.
And writable, because I formatted the backside of one of them. I actually had to cut out the little notch so that it showed as a writable surface. That was the trick on those old disks, is that they were single-sided until you cut the notch out on the other side, and then you could just flip them over, and they worked fine. It was pretty funny. But that they're all writable, that I didn't are readable, and they didn't have disk errors. That blows me away. That's kind of amazing. And that the Apple IIc drive that I've got worked fine. I didn't have to disassemble it and clean the drive heads or anything like that. I think it says something about that in that old tech. It had like a switch, so like when there was no disk in the drive, or when you inserted a disk, you basically pop up this thing that lifts the read head off of it. You stick the disk in, and then you pop it back down. So that 2C was stored with the drive head kind of closed, and as a result, it seems like no dust or anything got in there. I just turned it on, and it booted. It was pretty amazing. The only issue I had was finding, and I think I did mention this last time, finding a monitor for it, because it's just composite video out. And that's why I used my old camcorder as the monitor. It's the only way I could do it, which is super weird, but it works. I realized that there's an adapter. Again, how much money do I want to put into this thing? But there is, if I wanted to really get into it, there is an adapter I could buy that would let me go out to VGA. And I have a flat panel that does VGA that I could turn into an Apple II monitor. But I don't think I'm going to be creating the Apple II wing of my tech museum anytime soon, but who knows.
Other people have that kind of thing covered.
Yeah Anyway, it's the first Apple computer I bought, so that's, and I don't have that actual one, but I do have one from that era now, which is kind of fun.
There you go. Yeah. That's, now you've got a complete set.
Yeah, that's good. Emulators are great.
A gamut of 30 years.
Yeah, the running the Apple II in the emulator is awesome. You can crank it up to full speed, and it's like hilarious because it boots in a fraction of a second. Before we finish this topic, I have one other thing that I want to mention, which is just a curiosity that I find hilarious, which is when I started on the Apple II, the operating system that it ran was DOS 3.3, the disk operating system. When at some point in there, they created a new thing called ProDOS, mm-hmm. which was more modern, and a lot of the stuff I've got is on ProDOS, even though when I think of like classic Apple II, I think about DOS 3.3 and not ProDOS. But what's funny is, and I remembered this story, and I actually looked it up because I'm booting a disk that's running it now, is somebody released a new version of ProDOS for the Apple II in 2016. With new programs on it that are utilities that can be used to copy files and display them and all this stuff. It fixes bugs. It extends compatibility across the Apple II lines, so that version of ProDOS can run all the way down to the original Apple II, the Apple II and Apple II Plus, all the way up to the Apple II GS. It's just amazing. Like somebody, it shows that it's a small community, but there is this group of people who still love and know that thing backward and forward and can write this stuff. And the disk that I've got that I used to kick off the transfer process here is running that version, the 2016 version of ProDOS. So I love that. It actually makes me intrigued about the forthcoming release of the source code for the Lisa, for similar reasons, which is beyond a certain point, other than copyright and trademark and licensing encumbrances, like this is what needs to happen to technology, is that after a period of time, and it can be 20 or 30 years, I suppose, if it needs to be, but letting people in the community who care maintain it and understand it is,
right,
I think, a good thing. And so, you know, maybe something cool will come out of the whole Lisa source code being available. Apparently, yeah, everything except the dictionary, because the dictionary is copyrighted by the owner of the dictionary.
Well, that's abandonware is always kind of an interesting gray area. But I agree that, like, there are people who are passionate about that sort of thing. And shutting them down. Wow. Okay, Alexa. Alexa, shut up. I don't know what's happening anymore. I don't.
Now
I don't
it's know. A six color secret podcast.
Oh my God. Well, I was gonna say that people are passionate about that and they should be allowed to do it because it's not. I understand there are concerns of intellectual property, copyright, etc. But no one's gonna do anything with that. There is nothing in ProDOS. There's nothing in the Lisa OS that really is going to affect substantively anything, right? Like, I feel very strongly that that kind of vintage stuff should be essentially, you know, public domain, as it were, because
yeah,
there's nothing to be gained from it anymore, especially in technology.
Well, and you're losing, it's gone from being a viable product to important history. Now, I get, like, you know, the counter argument is something like Atari and Nintendo retro consoles, right? That's like the copyright's still there, and you'd think that that stuff is all irrelevant, but there's somebody's still making products out of them. And okay, fair enough. But at some point, if the choice is that it gets lost forever or not, and there was this story about the game developer who has done, I think they did Year Walk on iOS, and their next game is for consoles. And what they said is their frustration was they were spending huge amounts of time getting their old games on iOS to keep running because of this change and this requirement. You know, you have to go to 64-bit, and it crashes on this system and all that. And their point was they want their games to last and not expire. And this is one of those things where, again, at some point there's going to be an emulator and all of that. But if everything is locked up in the App Store,
yeah,
in the end, what's going to happen is we are going to be able to play iOS games from iOS 4. But it's only going to happen because somebody jailbroke the iPhone and pulled off an image of it and built an emulator. And somebody else took an IPA file, you know, an iPhone archive from iTunes or something like that, or something they pulled off a phone somewhere. Like, that's what's going to be required. It's going to be like the Star Wars despecialized edition, where even though there are actual legal authorities who have all of the material, they're not going to put it out there. And in the end, the only people will have it. You know what it's like? It's like the Doctor Who missing episodes, where the only audio of the episodes of Doctor Who that they deleted from the 60s that exists is fans who recorded it with a microphone attached to their TV when they were watching it in the 60s. And this is a little bit like that, where like the official people don't care.
It's that much harder, though, because of the digital rights management inherent in these things.
Yeah, exactly right. And so you end up with a situation where the people who have the legal right don't care, or don't care until it's too late. And the people who do care have limited access to this stuff. But what you risk is a very bad situation where in 20 years, we want to look at this app that everybody loved on iOS, and it can't be found or run, right?
Well, I've already lost things that got pulled from the store, right? Like, I had a version of, there was a version of the old Prince of Persia that they had ported to iOS. I can't remember what the company behind it was, but essentially it was the old Mac version of Prince of Persia updated and ported to iOS. But at some point it got pulled from the store, and I had the app for a while, but like, if you don't back up stuff locally these days, and I'm not even sure you can do that after the iTunes changes they made, you basically just, it's gone. Like, there's, it's not there anymore. And that's a bummer, because I like that game, and for whatever reason, they've decided not to keep putting it out there. So, it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe one day that stuff will come back, but it's just funny, just like with the emulator stuff, where the emulators, those aren't legal, but they're the only way for this stuff to survive, and that's too bad. So I don't know. It's a mistake to let stuff go, just rot away, because there's probably relevance in it. Other than college term papers, those can rot away. Turns out.
Faster and faster.
Turns out. All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for subscribing to Six Colors and supporting us and doing what we do.
I've got a plug.
Okay. And now here comes a plug.
I'm going to plug just because. Why not?
Oh, you have t-shirts that you're selling.
I'm selling shirts. Hey, if you want a shirt based on my book, I'm selling a shirt with the logo of the Commonwealth of Independent Systems on it. You can find it, I believe, at dmorin.com/shirts. Should take you to an order page. If you're interested, it's on the Cotton Bureau, and it's running until, I think, the 16th of January. I'm also giving away a free shirt if you subscribe to my mailing list, which you can find at dmorin.com. So if you don't feel like buying one, but you feel like, hey, I would take a free shirt if I won one, then you can check that out too, because I'll give one off at the end of the period. So enjoy. It's a cool looking shirt.
All right. I ordered one.
If I say so myself. Nice. Thank you.
In fact, I ordered a few Cotton Bureau shirts in my most recent order, and I think yours is the only one that has succeeded in getting its minimum.
Thank you. I hit it on day one, which was, I was also the first shirt of the new year, apparently, to succeed, according to Cotton Bureau. So that was kind of cool.
That is nice, because you have to go, oh man, you sold 44 of these. You're doing great.
I know. I'm doing it. But hey, we can always sell more.
Yeah, I'm the only one to have bought this other shirt. I really need to like promote it on Twitter or something and say people need to buy this shirt so that I can get one, because I like it. It's the Let's Go Astros, and it says it's Astros like the Houston Astros, but it's got an astronaut below it trying to catch a baseball comet. I really like it. I think it's great.
That's a cute shirt. You gotta find those space nerd baseball crossover people. That's the market there.
Yeah, totally. I'm going to tweet about it right now. This is going to be a live tweet on the Six College Podcast. We're breaking new ground here. I'm going to tweet, hey, space/baseball nerds, buy this shirt so I can get one. We'll just leave it at that.
There you go.
All right. Done.
Live tweeting.
Yeah, that was pretty good. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.